your turn to be afraid.
Are you a fan of things that go bump in the night? Chills up your spine, paralyzed by fright. Thrilled by horror at the center of a chat. Then welcome to the Nerds from the Crypt podcast.
Welcome back to Nerds from the Crypt, the podcast where we review your favorite and sometimes not so favorite horror movies and interview indie creators about their ongoing and upcoming horror projects. My name is Saul, and Greg will not be joining us today, unfortunately, but I have a guest here for us today, all the way from across the pond, Mrs. Lucy Sullivan. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I know it's a little bit more difficult to try to find some time during the middle of the day to join someone from the United States.
To do a podcast. It's always tricky.
Thank you very much. I wanted to just go ahead and just let people get to know you a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be talking about at least two projects, and maybe we'll see. Maybe you can tell us a little bit what we may be able to see in the future. Mm-hmm. But what led you to this point here in the career?
Oh, so I'm a comic artist and writer. So I guess some people call that cartoonist as well. I grew up in a pub in London, so I didn't think I'd end up doing anything like this at all. I thought I'd just be pouring pints and cleaning bars, you know, so, which I did do for quite a long time. I was a bartender and a waitress. I was really into snowboarding, so I went traveling. My mum's from New Zealand, and I went traveling to there to do snowboarding and work in bars and stuff. And my dad died when I was there, and I was sort of thrust back to London. And I just thought, oh, I've got to do something with my life. And I didn't feel like I could still stay in bars. So I went back to art school and got a degree in illustration and animation, and then moved into hand-drawn animation. So I always loved comics, but I wasn't originally thinking I could make a career in it. And animation's quite hard here. It's still very cute and child-orientated. And that's just, my work is sadly not that, although I'm not bothered about that. But if I try and draw something cute, it just looks like it's going to stab you. So I sort of just try to embrace what was there and just draw the way I want to draw. And then, you know, comics is just a much greater market for that. So I was teaching life drawing, and one of my, I wouldn't call him a student because he's a really well-known cartoonist himself, Nick Abadzis, who did a book called Leica that won an Eisner. He was in my class, and we were, you know, making good chats about comics and stuff, and he just said, why don't you think about making one? And it all sort of came together, and suddenly I was making a comic. And I had a baby and then had time to sort of think about it a bit more and started making Barking. So I think once Barking sort of did pretty well, then I just shifted to being full-time comics, as well as obviously raising my daughter and doing all of that stuff at the same time.
So it wasn't initially your passion, but it's turned into something more.
It was a passion. I've read comics since I was a kid, so especially in a pub we had like live-in staff, so I got to read things I shouldn't have necessarily have read or watched, actually, because we'll probably get onto the sort of horror influences. And a lot of the horror I saw was because our bartenders often led like VHS tapes around, and I got to see things that I really shouldn't have been watching, but they had a huge impact. But no, I read comics as a hobby. I just hadn't considered that I'd be able to make them. It just hadn't occurred to me that would be possible. And it wasn't really until I met Nick and met someone who was doing it as a job. You know, like I guess when I was a teen and reading them, there was things like Tank Girl and Deadline over here. And, you know, they were all kind of like these sort of rock star artists and stuff. You know, it was just the idea of being able to do what Jamie Hewlett was doing is just mad to me, you know. So
hey, I think we're in a moment where almost as long as you have the drive, you can do something, especially with crowdfunding, with you can self-publish, or you can find a way to bring it out.
And I think that's it. Crowdfunding is the great kind of leveler of the sort of creative classes. You know, anyone can do it, and you can access an audience, and you can get your projects off the ground. And it's just an amazing tool for that. And although Barking was crowdfunded with a crowdfunding publisher, I went on to do a load of Kickstarters after that. And then I did a Crowdfunder, which is the Canadian kind of version of Kickstarter, for Shelter, my second comic. Without having been able to just make the work you want to make without having to worry about does it fit in with a publisher or an editor or something, because it's so valuable, I think, especially if you're trying to do slightly different work, which I think I probably come under the banner of. I don't know.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that real quick, because your first comic was Barking.
Yeah. The wrong way with it, I think, because I sort of started with a graphic novel, which is a really stupid way to start making comics. But I did make a bunch of zines as well. But yeah.
Now, did that come out in chapters, or did you make it all at once?
So originally I was planning on self-publishing it, and I was going to do it in chapters. I sort of figured it was going to be a 10 chapter story arc, and that I could either publish it as like two separate comics or find a way to do it that way, kind of thing. And I did two chapters, showed it to my friend Nick. He lives in the States. He lives in not New York City, up from that. He's in Union City, so that's more like New Jersey, right? He'd come over, and I'd showed it to him, and he was like, you know, we should try and get you a publisher for this. So he took me to, there's a publisher here, Self Made Hero, and they had like a 10th anniversary party. So Nick took me to that as his like plus one, and introduced me to lots of people. And it was mad. There was like creators that I had their comics, and there was publishers I knew, and it was a real like one of those, oh my god, that's blah blah, and can I just go and say hi? And I was a real fangirl. It was a bit, I hope I didn't embarrass myself, but I had this comic with me, and he introduced me to Lizzie Kay, who was at Unbound at the time, and she was starting off this new graphic novels list. So Unbound was this crowdfunding publisher, and they had Ram V, who's currently on Batman Detective series at the moment, and he's done Lila Star and loads of stuff. I mean, Ram's amazing. But he'd done a book called Graffiti's Wall with Unbound, and I'd noticed that, knew Lizzie about Lizzie from that, so it was really cool to meet her. And then she asked to see Barking, and so I sent it to her. And after a painful wait, because I had a jury service here, which was this horrific murder trial, which was really intense, I came out of that, and Lizzie wanted to do Barking. So it was published in 2020, but I had to raise £13,000, and I had no audience. So it took me about 18 months of crowdfunding. It was a long time, because it's a lot of money, and it's even at sort of, I think they were doing it for like 20 quid a book, because it's a, you know, hardback. But yeah,
so it took me a long time. So did they come up with that amount?
Yeah, they budget it. And
okay.
I mean, I'm not with them anymore, so I can be a bit more free about how I talk about it. But it was hard to justify once I found out the cost of the print runs and stuff. And there was a mistake made with the initial print runs, so I ended up getting a printer here that all the indie comics people use, Rich at Comic Printing, who did this amazing job. And you know, that was sort of like a £5,000 print run, so you're like, okay, so I raised £13,000, where's the rest of that going? And it's like, oh, it pays everyone's wages at Unbound, because I didn't get paid anything to make it. So I ended up getting an Arts Council grant here, so it's like a government funded grant to make the book and help with the production costs of it. Plus, I had a comic festival here, the Lakes Comic Art Festival, who put some money in as well. So I raised about $6,500 on my own, and then got money through Arts Council and the Lakes to put towards the final total. But yeah, I saw, you know, very little of that myself, apart from the stuff I got from Arts Council to make it. But, you know, this it's just one of those live and learns. It's like I could have put it out through Kickstarter probably myself. I probably wouldn't have done it as a hardback, and I probably wouldn't have got the kind of reach I got. You know, it was in bookshops here, and, you know, they sold it through Amazon and everything. And it did well, but I think I still sold most of the books myself. So, you know,
I did recently hear from someone on Facebook saying that they were offered a deal with a publisher. They didn't name the publisher, mm-hmm. but then they found out that most of the time that they have to do their own funding and yeah. they get very little. So I don't know if it's the same or not. It sounds like the same process.
But if it is, I'd tell your friend to walk away. Very sharpish.
I don't think they ended up doing it. What really sent it back is they were excited about it, but they found out that even though they're publishing it and doing all that they still had to take care of all the Kickstarter and all the crowdfunding themselves. So it's like, well, yeah, all they're really What's doing the is point? Printing. Yeah.
Yeah. And mine was supposed to be that they would do print and distribution and they'd put it out for foreign sales, but they made my editor redundant part way through the production and didn't get a replacement comics editor. So I was dealing with people that were used to dealing with literary books or cookbooks, and they just didn't know what they were doing. So, and they just
a little bit lost different.
Yeah. I've got a new publisher. I'm not allowed to say who yet, and they are specifically comics. So there'll be a new edition because it's sold out. I managed to sell all the print run. Nice. So I sold like a 1.5k books, mostly by myself because the publisher did Unbounded nothing. So it's sold out. I got the rights back and I've got a new publisher, and they're proper comics publisher. So I'm really looking forward to what the future for it's going to be, which is very, very exciting.
Congratulations. I did see that you had posted about that on Twitter. So
yeah, it was just mm-hmm. this week, just on Thursday. Yeah. So I'm really, really thrilled. It's been a long... So yeah, because that came out 2020 and I'd all but sold out by the end of 21, I all but sold out of the graphic novels, and I was just holding back enough so I could do Comic Cons here and stuff. But I had to take it off my website at the end of last year, and it's been really sad to see it just sort of gradually going out of print. But no, back in the game. So very excited.
Nice. Well, let's talk about Barking.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's your first one. For those who have not heard of Barking, describe it?
Yeah, it's quite a tricky one. So it's loosely based on a breakdown I had in my 20s after my dad died. So I had a really dark period and I got diagnosed with depression and anxiety. So I sort of took what I went through, and I'd seen friends be sectioned. So that means to be forcibly put into mental health institutes here, NHS kind of run ones. So it's the National Health Service. And then I was researching around stuff and to do with grief and things like that. And so this was back in 2009, I started developing it. So it was still a point where people weren't really talking about mental health. So I sort of started developing that. And then I started seeing connections between the idea of this kind of black dog syndrome and the idea of there's a folk horror kind of link here, or folklore link to Old Shuck or Black Shuck. It's like the dog that haunts the moors, which is also things like American Werewolf in London. That's where all of that comes from. And Sherlock Holmes, Hands of Baskerville. So I was looking into that.
Oh, yeah, okay. And
sort of links into kind of phantasmagorical links to the idea of this like black dog that hounds you as a form of depression, rather than just sort of talking about the fact that I was very angry and wanted to pick fights with everyone because I was depressed. So I took that run, I sort of ran with that, and then started thinking about, well, what about if the person who's died, unlike my dad, who I had a great relationship with, when I got back, a lot of the problems I had and my return were with the living, and particularly a particular friend who was really, really hard work. And I was just like, oh, what if it was that person that had died? And what if it was that person that I was having to deal with? And what if I created this character who I could embody what I'd been through and what my friends had been through, but I placed them in a hospital and got them to deal with an actual black dog and an actual dead friend. And a lot of that was from American Werewolf in London, actually. I saw it when I was 6, which was probably a bit young to watch.
I started like watching that. Horror at around 4 or 5, yeah. So
right. And do you know, it's amazing how many people in the creative industries have started watching horror at a really young age. It's like the amount of people you're like, oh yeah, I saw that when I was 2. And you're like, okay, explains a lot. You know, I mean, I was definitely too young, but it sat with me. I'd had best friend had died when I was 5 of leukemia, and this sort of idea which was very intense because of the I was 5, so I didn't really comprehend it, that he was dead or anything like that, but the idea of the tubes, you know, that sort of body horror of that was very like hard to process. And then
I would imagine that is even scarier at that point in your life, seeing all that, than the actual thought of death.
Yeah, definitely. I was terrified of hospitals. You know, the idea that he just wasn't about was one thing, but that seeing him in the hospital was really creepy. But then I found it weirdly comforting that in the film, the guy can talk to his friend, even though he's like falling apart and it's partly dead. He can look in the mirror and have this like chat with his mate. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, I don't know. There's something about my head that was like, oh, there's something kind of comforting. But it just stuck in as this concept of grief in my head, probably because I was so young, and it just made sort of sense of it. And I think every time I've lost someone, my brain just kept going back to that. So it made sense to me to bring it into Barking and put it in the book. So in the book, she's got a friend who's died under like quite upsetting circumstances. Her body's been found in the River Thames, and we join the main character, Alex Otto, 18 months after, where she's basically on a bridge contemplating jumping off because she's being chased by this black dog that's telling her to do that. And she's not really going to do it, but she's caught in a really dodgy position by the police, and they section her under the Mental Health Act here, which is an actual thing that can happen if the police deem that you're a danger to yourself or to others. You can be forcibly put into a mental health institution here, and it's very surprising how quickly that can happen and your liberty can be just taken away. And I thought it's a horror setup, right? You're like stuck in this place without your liberty, but there's nothing to stop the things in her mind going with her. So the dog comes out of the floor in the hospital and joins her there, and then her dead friend comes out of the ceiling and also joins her there.
Fucking so her. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's like dealing with being in an institution alongside having to deal with the fact that her mental health is manifested around her in this kind of phantasmagorical form. So it's quite out there. <as a book.
laughs> No, I started reading it, and I'm like I was telling you earlier, I had a hectic week, so I didn't have a lot of time. But if I had the normal time I had in a week, I would have read this all in one sitting. And you said you do both the art and the lettering?
Yeah. So I did a kind of loose script with that one. It was sort of more like a kind of write a scene and the dialogue. And then I did a really weird process of kind of just like free sketching ideas for each chapter. And then I'd form it into how I thought it could work with some thumbnails. And then I laid it all out in Photoshop. So it's all drawn with biro and typewriter carbon sheets. So I don't know if you're old enough to know what those are, but they're like you used to put a bit of piece of paper and a sheet of carbon into a typewriter, and as you hit it, it would type the carbon on. So I use those to draw with. So I put the black sheet on top of my paper and I draw with like dip pens and sometimes sticks. I mean, for the black dog, I used my nails a lot. I just literally just like scratched at it to get it across.
I was about to ask you, like, how did you get that style?
Yeah, it's sort of a mad combination of, I used to teach drawing on location here. So I teach at the uni I went to, and we'd just go out in the streets of London. Sometimes we'd go abroad, we'd go to New York or Spain, and you just go on the streets and you have to draw what you can see, the people, the cars, everything, no matter what. And one of my students one time brought this carbon paper along with her, and she was doing these, it's effectively like a monoprint on the spot. And I just got obsessed with it and started using it to draw myself. And I started making zines with it. And then when I started developing barking, it just seemed like a natural kind of progression to use it, because you get this, it's not a heavy black like an ink, it's more like a charcoal. So you can get this really kind of loose feeling with it, and then you can make
smoky
marks. Yes, exactly. Smoky. That's perfect. Yeah, it's a really satisfying thing. And my studio is like covered in these like ripped up bits of carbon paper by the end. It looks quite crazed, but it's a very sort of physical way to create art. I really enjoy it as a process.
There's some images here. I don't know. I don't know if you ever read or saw the scary stories to tell in the dark.
No.
There. What's his name? Steven? Is it Steven Gamble, the artist? I'll look it up. But there's some pictures or some images here that kind of remind me of that.
Oh, interesting. What was it called?
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Scary. Oh no, I'm going to check that out. Lovely.
Yeah.
It's amazing to hear when people see your work and connect it with other work. I'm yet to be
yours. Yours are
a
lot more
female.
Darker.
I always get compared to male artists, which is interesting as well.
The reason why I say yours is darker is just because of the carbon. I believe it's because of the carbon. His I think is more a little bit more traditional, so it's not, it doesn't look as dark, and it's also a little bit of a older. But yeah, no, those are some of the books that I probably shouldn't have been reading in elementary.
Right.
and they've actually made a movie of it, but the thing that I think most people, most kids growing up in my time that grew up with them, what they remember are the drawings.
Yeah.
The stories. Yeah, you remember definitely. The stories because of the drawings.
Yeah. And on weird things, like I remember VHS covers and album covers and posters and things. Like I've had a bartender who had an ELO poster, so the Electric Light Orchestra, and it was just these robots sort of having a kind of, I don't know, like they're in boats and they were just having this kind of like banquet on the river, but you realize that what they're eating and doing is like dead people. And it's just amazing how these things just like sit in your head forever and you just absorb them. But yeah, definitely the pictures, I think, yeah, they're a very long-standing image in a lot of people's minds.
And on top of the drawings, I think when you said earlier that your style is different from the cutesy cartoons, definitely, I really enjoy this type of art style. But
thank you.
Not only do you use the actual line work and the drawings to tell the story, but also the what is it called? The type, the speech bubbles. At some points it's legible, and at some points it's what is it called?
Yeah, it's illegible. Yeah, it's impossible. It's hard to decipher, and it's totally intentional.
Yeah, it's I don't mean to be comparing you, but there is other I don't know what movie it is, where someone who is going through something like similar, and they're writing, and as they're writing, you go from legible to as they're writing this paper, the words start to get a little bit wider, a little bit more loopy, a little bit more like it starts from real neat to very, very sloppy. And it just reminded me of that.
Well, I did quite a lot of research into psychology, and I found this fascinating book called Agnes's Jacket. And in it, they talk about a group of people, mostly in the UK, who have been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and eschewed medication and form their own groups where they basically have like an underground therapy group where they just talk to each other because they felt like no one ever asked them what happened before the voices kind of came along. And one of them speaks really brilliantly about what the psychosis was like and how they basically were going to jump in front of a tube train. And there were all these people talking to them, trying to tell them not to do it. But the voices they heard were the ones in their head. So no matter what was coming out of people's mouths, they could just hear what was in their head. So I really wanted to get that across in Barking. It's just like, you can't imagine that just because you're saying a thing that that person in the grip of something like this can hear you, you know. And I wanted it to be really difficult to read at times. And also when, you know, when I was depressed, I really fought with what my mind was telling me and what was happening in the room. And I think it's important to kind of get across that aspect as well. Like, you know, you could be, someone could be having a normal conversation with you. Meanwhile, your head is telling you some pretty unpleasant things. And how do you sort of portray that? And it, for me, the lettering was a really important part of that, and quite a challenging part. And I was aware that I was slightly breaking a few rules with it, but I think it was a book that I just thought, what the hey, I'm just gonna see what happens if I just make this the way I want to make it, kind of thing.
So you said Barking, while it's out of print right now, it should be back in print pretty soon, hopefully.
Yeah there will be a delay at the moment. I was going to put the digital on my website, but my new publisher does digital, so I can't do that now. apologies for that. But it will be slated this year. I've got the last of the hardbacks and I'm just selling them in person at events in the UK, and then hopefully it will be 2024. It's going to be back on release, so that's very exciting.
What's definitely recommended from us, at least.
Thank you for
anyone who's listening, go ahead and get your hands on it when you're able to.
Yeah, and it will be. And I'm hoping my new publishers are much more better at overseas sales and stuff. So I'm really hoping they'll get US and Canada distribution as well. So hopefully it'll be a lot easier than having to pay like the shipping costs to get over there. It's just insane, you know?
Yeah, I've heard that the shipping, I don't know if it's cost more from here to over there or over there over here, but
we're in Brexit Britain, so you know everything's just costs a fortune now because of the idiots that put us in this position, unfortunately. But yeah, it seems to be a mix between, it's particularly to the US and Canada, it's particularly high. But I found a kind of economy shipping that you could do for like about £6, but it takes 8 weeks. So if you're willing to wait 2 months, it will be a lot cheaper. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I think it's okay with something like Barking because it's a, you know, hardback graphic novel, and you know, at least if you're paying for something big. But Shelter's like a 34-page kind of softback comic, and it's a fiver. You know, the idea that you're then paying £6 to ship it is just, it's a lot, you know.
And well, that's the second project we're going to talk about today.
Shelter.
So what
I did a load of sort of collaborations before getting to that. So I did, after Barking, I did about 2 years of collaborations, so just working as an artist, which was really valuable. Actually, I did like a lo-fi sci-fi with a writer here, Fraser Campbell, called Indexed, which was a sort of one-shot thing that we drew during the pandemic, and it's a sort of a post-pandemic world. So that was a bit of a one to do. But I also did one for Razor Blades, which is the horror comic that James Tynion puts out with Steve Fox, and I did that with Dan Waters. Dan's done loads of things. I think he's on Swamp Thing at the moment. Can't remember what he's writing at the moment, But we did a Sweeney Todd story for that, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, man.
It was great to do.
There's a Sweeney Todd off-Broadway production going around, and they were here in I'm in Texas and yeah. Austin. They were in Austin. I'm in San Antonio. But I wanted to go watch it, but it fell right on a Wednesday in the middle of the week. Like at 6 o'clock, and I'm like, like, why couldn't it be the weekend? I would have been out.
And I've heard good things about it as well. It's meant to be mm-hmm. a really good one to see. I mean, it was interesting to do the short story together, because Dan obviously put the barber chair in, and the minute you start drawing it and thinking about the mechanics of it, you're just like, there's just no way this could happen. These chairs are so heavy. And I live in a Victorian house, and let me tell you, our floorboards are not well made. You know, it's like they couldn't even handle the weight of the chair, let alone some sort of contraption that flipped it. And it's what's so great about it as a penny dreadful, because it's so gruesome and believable. And yet, in practical terms, it's just impossible. You know, there's just no way that happened, or at least not as a contraption. You know, he couldn't have flipped the chair or anything like that. But mm-hmm. it was a lot of fun.
And not to get you off. And not to get off subject too much, but I know that when it was a penny dreadful, Sweeney Todd was not really the tragic backstory that we know today, right? He was more of a real bad guy.
It wasn't later on. Utter. Yeah, there was no tragic backstory. It was just he was just an utter. Yeah, it was just sociopath. You know, he was just up mm-hmm. for killing people, and he found a partner in crime with Mrs. Lovett, the pie maker across the road, who, and they shared a basement. And even that is just not practical in London. You don't have that. You might be able to share a basement with the person next door, but across the street, no, there'd be like, you know, lots of sewage and pipes, and, you know. So it's a really fascinating idea. And Dan, his dad was a black cab driver and used to work around Fleet Street. So he sort of grew up with this kind of idea of Fleet Street. And I'd done my jury service up that way as well. I'd done my jury service at the Old Bailey, so it's all proper old London. And it's a really fascinating thing to kind of get into the history of and draw. And then Dan's script was brilliant, because it's sort of like, it's a kid who, an adult who dreams, a modern adult who dreams about Sweeney Todd. And but he's always a child in the dream. And then one time he goes in and he gets away. He never goes into the barbershop. And then in this dream, he goes in, like he finally walks into the barbershop. And obviously then it becomes, is it a dream? Is it real? Like, what's happening here, kind of thing. And it gets really quite abstract, but it was a lot of fun to do. And I really enjoyed figuring out how to draw bodies falling down chutes, you know, like finding reference for that was intriguing. Skateboarders, by the way, you just look up skateboarder fails and you're like, oh yeah, that's how someone looks.
That's what happens. Yeah.
Flailing everywhere.
I have to find that one to be able to get it. Cause that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I can send you a link, but Razor Blades came out. So I was in Razor Blades 3, I think. So it was put out initially. It's on James Tynion's got a website, readrazorblades.com. And it's still, I think, a pay for what you want to read it scenario if you get the digital, which is really interesting. So this is a real like labor of love. People are just kind of doing it for that. And they're a collection of kind of 8-page horror stories. So it's pretty formidable. But it got picked up by Image. And end of last year, it came out as the first volume with Image. So I got my first Image publication, which is really exciting to see. But it's a behemoth of a book. They sent me a comp and it's like, it's just massive. I mean, it's hardback. I think it's like $25, so it's really quite expensive as well. But it is a beautiful, massive thing, and it's just all horror. So it's really
$25 for a hardback.
It's not so bad, right? And it's got to be about two or 300 pages worth. It's a lot of comics in there. So I do recommend checking it out. And and obviously it's image, so you can get it in the US easily. But yeah, it's my our story was part of that as well, so it's in there, and it's one of the only black and white and red ones, because you gotta have some red. But, yeah, it's still in the kind of barking style, which sort of suits Victorian kind of London and Sweeney Todd as well.
Well, I was going to say, because the other one, Shelter, it takes place in 1969, I think.
It does, yeah. So, but I did that with Dan, and then I did I got to do a Black Hammer for Jeff Lemire, which was amazing, which I wrote and drew. And then he said to me, originally he was going to do something, publish something of Shelter. And then he said, what if we can sort of somehow combine the two? And I said, I could set a Madame Dragonfly story in the world of Shelter. So I've got this sort of, it's London, Shelter, the first, so it's the first of a series, and this is called Early Doors. And it's set in 1979 London, so like towards the end of the 60s, and just at a point where there was quite a lot of change, obviously, happening in the world as well. And what I wanted to do was, there's a kind of a lot of stories and films about the men of London at that time, particularly the kind of like Long Good Friday and that kind of, they're not really gangsters, but they're like criminals, you know, and that kind of world in London. But there's not much about the women, unless it's kind of like kitchen sink dramas or something kind of quite depressing. And I wanted to do something around the women that I remember as a kid that would come in our pub. And we had like two bars. And we had one that was where we had a live music pub. So we had one where all the rock was playing. And then we had a smaller one where often there was mostly women sitting around chatting. And they were some quite formidable women. You know, these were like, never mind upsetting the local sort of hard man. If you got on the wrong side of his mum, then you're in a lot of trouble, you know. So I wanted to do something about those women. So I basically invented this character, Mammy McGee, and it's set around the London Irish community, which my dad was from Ireland. And it's quite a big part of West London at the time, was this kind of Irish community. And so Mammy is like a local fixer. And she has a sort of house of girls that can have singular kind of talents that can help fix any problem. But there is always a price to pay for that. And in this story, a young girl has come over from Ireland, Elga, and found herself in a predicament and has to get help from Mammy. And it's whether she's willing to pay the price to get that help. So it's a folk horror. I'd call it, I think there's probably, is there some kitchen, it's probably a bit kitchen sink drama, a bit of sort of Mike Lee or something in there, but it was a lot of fun to do. And I really enjoyed sort of creating this world with these kind of women who, it has a supernatural element to it. So I sort of would put it in that folk horror thing, because it's a bit like, you know, kind of Blood on Satan's Claw or Wicker Man, where you don't fully know what's at the root of these women and what they're capable of. And I basically use quite a lot of Celtic mythology in it. So I've had quite a lot of fun taking figures from Celtic mythology and kind of weaving them into this woman and into this part of London. It's been a lot of fun to create. And so far it's going down quite well, I think, but it's always hard to tell when it's your own work. But I crowdfunded it and had about 250 backers and no complaints so far. So, you know, that's always a helpful thing. And it's on my site, but obviously it's only in print at this stage. And I've got I am considering putting the digital up, I think, because of the cost of shipping is a lot and I haven't signed a deal yet, but I do have a tentative kind of publisher for it. But yeah, it's hopefully I'll get the digital up on that soon, because I think it's, although I'm really pleased with the artwork, because it's I added watercolor.
Yeah, that it looks awesome. I mean, I like the way Barking look as well. But the watercolor kind of just adds a little bit more
atmosphere to it. Yeah, I think especially for that time in London. I wanted it to feel a little bit like seeing it through like a cathode TV or something, you know?
Well, that's what I was, that's why I was like 1969, but before I, because you have it there in the, as a, what is it called? I don't know. I'm not too familiar with the actual title, like, I guess a title or place.
Oh, like yeah, like a timestamp kind of thing.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, before I got to that part, this is putting me back in. It makes you feel like it's, you're further back in time than modern day, because modern day I feel like it would be really bright, but when you think about the past, it looks a little bit more washed out because of mostly because of because what we see, you know, on film. It's because of the quality of the film, it looks washed out.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to have that because the colors were much brighter. I used primary colors mostly with the watercolor. I didn't really mix them too much. But when I put it onto Photoshop to have a look at it, I was like, it's too bright. So I got a layer and whacked it over the top. So it felt like having effectively, I guess, a screen over it. And then I was like, that feels a bit more sort of flattened, you know. I wanted it to have that that feeling. So it's great if that's working, because you make these decisions and you're like, does that mean anything? I don't know, but it feels like it should happen. You know, but
no, it does. You do see that.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'm pleased to hear it, because it's a tricky pitch again, you know. I don't seem to be making it easier myself, and I think you said you're about sort of about a third in or something, so I you haven't got to the horror bit yet.
Mm-mm,
but it's not yet. My daughter walked in when I was drawing the denouement, and she was like, oh, what's that, Mum? And you're like, oh, we're gonna have to have a conversation about Celtic mythology and how brutal it is. she's very into it now, which is good. So you'll see when you get to it. And maybe 8 was a bit young for that, but she's fine.
I honestly feel like, I know, even because I'm in a lot of horror groups, and there's a lot of times where people say, how young is too young to introduce someone to horror? I go, really, it depends on the child,
doesn't it? She's sort of intrigued by it, but I have like terrible nightmares every time I watch any horror. So I sort of really pick what I'm going to watch. Like even Midsommar, I didn't sleep properly for months afterwards. It just sat with me and I'd have these horrific dreams. I couldn't even watch The Babadook because I got 20 minutes in and went, I'm never sleeping again. I had 20 minutes and I couldn't sleep for a week. It was just ridiculous. So I love it, but I have to be really cautious about what I watch.
My wife's the same way. She doesn't like horror, but when she does watch horror with me, it can be too late at night.
Yeah.
So she has to be able to watch a little something right before she falls asleep.
Oh, I love it. And it's just such a curse to not be able to just sit and enjoy it. And I know I'm going to pay a price. Like, we've just started The Last of Us because I needed to be mentally in a place that I could handle not sleeping. You know, and my partner, you know, he was an animator and he teaches it as well, and he can be very like, oh, you know, I've worked on film set. So he worked on a horror film called Isolation, shot an island, and he built like the monsters for it and stuff. So we've got, you know, pictures and puppets around our house, so it's not like we're adverse to that kind of thing. But he just isn't affected by it at all, whereas I will just be up in the middle of the night just freaking out. And my daughter's sadly like that too, so we have to be kind of cautious. But she plays Minecraft. She spends most of her time like setting zombies on fire. So, you know, there's like there's always a balance, you know.
Yeah. You have to know your child well enough to know if they're able to handle what you're about to show them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's quite helpful for her to be able to go, well, you know, you can see that I've drawn this and that it's painted, so you can understand that it's just, you know, paint on paper that has created this image. But I mean, she was quite helpful when I was making Barking, because she was very judgmental about how I drew the dog. She would come in and go, "Oh, mummy, your horse looks great," and you're like, "Oh, okay, that's not working. Better get redrawing that," you know. And she would only have been, God, about two or something, and she would see this like terrifying black dog, but she'd say things like, you know, "Oh, your character looks really sad. I think she needs a friend." And you're like, "Oh my God, that's such a succinct reading of what this book's about. You know, she is sad and she does need a friend." And yeah, kids just get that stuff, you know, which is just extraordinary. But yeah, I have a feeling she's gonna find horror and really love it, but will forever pay the price like I do. You know, I think we're not people who separate fiction and fantasy very well from reality. We just sort of, once you see it, it's then born into existence, and there's no not summing it again. We shall see.
You had talked about, I don't remember if it was actually part of the one we started recording or not, but you had brought up about how back in the day, even like what, 2000, what did you say, around 2008, 2009, that the world didn't really treat mental illness or mental health as well as it is now. And I had when we were reviewing Misery, I had brought up with Lyndon White. I had brought up the fact that you've seen Misery, right? Or
of course.
Okay,
you know, Kathy Bates is just perfect
with the Annie Wilkes character. That we really don't, we see a little bit of her backstory, but the whole villainous arc that she has is really comes from her mental illness.
Yeah.
And back in the day, it was just, we don't really need to give too much. It's that person is mentally ill. That's what's going to make them the bad person. Whereas now we're starting to see more compassion towards that, you know, just because someone does have some mental health issue doesn't necessarily make them a bad person.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
we need to treat
them. It was a big character trope for a long time. And I think, you know, the scarier people are the people who know exactly what they're doing and do it regardless, you know, not someone who's in the grip of a fantastic delusion as she is. You know, she's obsessed with this writer, and she's a bit like, she reminds me of the main aunt in like Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, you know, yes.
Particularly the TV version, which I read the book and I listened to the audiobook, but I think the TV version is actually significantly better. And I love Margaret Atwood's stuff. But that sort of Aunt Lydia character, you know, it's that sort of like, "Oh, we're here for you and everything we're doing is the right thing for you. And we're just going to cut your hand off because that's the right thing to do." And I love that kind of character, but you've got to be really careful about not wrapping it in mental health as well. I think it's a really challenging kind of balance. I've got in my next shelter story, which I'm doing at the moment, I've got a woman like that. I've got an opposite to my main mammy, who's this sort of like caring but slightly terrifying grandmother. But I've got a sort of really English version, which is a nana, and she's horrid, and I'm really enjoying creating her, really making a point that she is not mentally ill. She knows exactly what she's doing, and she knows the damage she's causing, and she's just rotten, you know. And there's no background to that, but there probably would be, you know. It would be the way we're raised, the things we go through, you know, they make us who we are. And I think particularly in those eras, you know, like, I had a very terrifying grandmother, and she was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and was in and out of hospital. And she was just like known as the local madwoman, you know. She was just the local crazy lady, and no one ever spoke to her about what happened. And as she came home, her brother fought for the British in the Second World War, and she came home one day and he'd gassed himself in her oven, you know. And you just think, well, that would that would do it, right? That would be enough to turn you onto that. And you've just got to think about, yeah, I guess, especially those eras, because it was all right where you just get up the next day and you get on with it. It's all this sort of stiff upper lip rubbish, you know, and yeah, the idea yeah. that you could need to talk about it or work through those feelings when you had stuff to do and she had, you know, seven kids and a husband and she didn't have time to sit around and reflect on how traumatic it might have been to find her brother like that. But I'm sure it was a huge part of what happened to her, you know. So, yeah, I think it's really fascinating to sort of take modern knowledge and apply it to people that didn't know anything about it but would still be feeling the impacts of what was happening to them, particularly around mental health, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky balance. And frankly, there's nothing scarier than, you know, the horror of what can happen to your own mind, you know. It's beyond anything else.
Yeah, I think when you talk, nowadays at least, when you talk about mental health or mental illness, the horror is more within the person who is going experiencing the issue more than what they're going to do to someone else, because at the end of the day, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know
absolutely
what's going on. So you should really try to put yourself in their shoes. Like, how would you feel all of a sudden you're seeing things that are not there, or, and you know, I don't even know how to express what I'm trying to say.
No,
there
because, I get what you mean.
Yeah.
I must watch Misery again with a deeper sort of thought on that, because it's a really fascinating thing to consider again, I think, mm-hmm. especially in light of sort of having gone through barking and making something like that myself. It's really interesting to think about it. So thanks for the heads up. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So are you, I know you're getting ready for the next chapter for Shelter, but are you currently, other than Last of Us, watching anything, reading anything horror-wise?
I'm always trying to read it. Horror-wise, so we started The Last of Us. We finished, haven't done a horror in a while, because like I said, I've sort of really struggle. But I've been doing rewatches of old folk horror for Shelter, just to try and make sure that I'm kind of definitely working in that genre. And so I rewatched Blood on Satan's Claw, and I'm building up for Saint Maud and The Witch. I don't know how you meant to say The Witch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to watch that. And there's a new one that I'm desperate to see called The Nanny, which I think is set in Brooklyn. And it's about kind of diaspora mixed with horror. And it looks really great. It's a sort of like, I got Shudder out so that I could watch a couple of these things. And a documentary, actually. There's a brilliant documentary on Shudder called something like Woods Bewitched, and I have to find out what it's called. It's a really great documentary on folk horror. And
it's
it's called something like Bewitched Woodlands and something else. It's a really long title, and they should have maybe just thought about that. But it's very, very good. And every time I get somewhere with it, I'm like, I've got to stop and now watch that horror. And it turns out, luckily, most of them are on Shudder, so it's very helpful to sort of go between them. So I've sort of got a load of them lined up, and it's just finding the point where I think I cannot sleep enough to watch them, which is always interesting to do. But otherwise, we watch a lot of sort of sci-fi. We just finished Station 11. I don't know if you've seen that, but that's quite an interesting kind of post-apocalypse kind of setup. But it's like a traveling Shakespeare company. That's got some interesting moments because it's quite intense. And I definitely would say it was like hitting on some horror beats. But there are basically a traveling Shakespeare company that go around the lakes of Chicago after the world's wiped out by a flu. And again, it was written prior to the pandemic, so it must have been quite intense for people to make it after the pandemic happened. But that was a
I recently started watching Inside Number 9.
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. I've watched the first three.
Have you got to, it's called something like Christine's Christine's Tale? There's like a one woman one, and she's in a flat.
I have not.
And is an amazing episode. It's Sheridan Smith, the actress. It's an astonishing one. So I can't really wait to recommend get to it. And I've got a podcast that I'm obsessed with called The Uncanny, which is like a British podcast, which is all about real life hauntings. And they've got a live show on at the moment, actually, and I'm so desperate to see that. And they get Mark Gatiss on quite a lot to talk to them, who's one of the co-writers and actors in Inside Number 9. So I recommend Uncanny.
Doesn't he come out a lot in Doctor Who?
Yes, he's a huge Doctor Who fan. Yeah. And he writes he loves kind of the idea of a Christmas horror. So he's been like trying to bring back kind of Christmas horror stuff on the BBC over here and stuff like that. He's great, Mark Gatiss. He's a big horror fan and a big sort of exponent of how culturally important it is and how much it's got to say, you know. So I think I'm so desperate to be able to do more of it, but I'm such a coward. It's ridiculous. But I'm building up, and hopefully I've put a sort of time limit that I hope by summer that I've seen a fair few of those films so that I can bring them into my research a little bit more as well. Because I certainly draw enough kind of horrifying things. So you think I'd be able to take it back a little bit, like take it from someone else's mind. But I do find it hard, definitely.
Well, Lucy, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day. I know, like I said before, it's not easy just to drop everything you're doing in the middle of the day and come on just to talk.
Oh, no, it was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
When your other stuff comes out, let us know. We would be more than happy not only to tweet about it, but also talk about it. Eventually, we'll get back to reviewing movies. So if you want to do that as well, just let us know.
Finally get through some of these. But, you know, you just let me know. You ever want to talk about American Werewolf, I'm your girl.
Yeah, we actually haven't done that one on the podcast.
Oh, have you not? Oh, well, there you go. There's a big one for me because that's sort of, I think I live in that movie half the time. So, you know. But, I really appreciate it. And people can find me online and whatnot, but the next shelter is probably a way away. It's looking like it's massive, but the new one, I'll try and get a digital up as soon as I can, and that should be a lot easier to read. I mean, if you want to get the print, it's available in my web shop as well, but it's obviously you got to pay for that shipping fee, which is a bit of a pain.
Yeah. Well, where can people find you online?
So you can find my website is lucysullivanuk.com. That's all one word, Lucy Sullivan UK. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram and all of those as at Lucy Sullivan UK.
And I'll make sure to put the links in the description as well.
Thank you. Appreciated.
Well, once again, thank you very much for joining us here. And I want to thank everybody for joining us on this episode. Let us know what you think. And I recommend getting both of these projects, and I'm gonna look for some of the side projects that you did or you talked about too. So
thank you.
Yeah, so once again, thank you very much, and everyone, we'll see you guys next time here on Nerd from the Crypt.
Are you a fan of things that go bump in the night? Chills up your spine, paralyzed by fright, thrilled by horror at the center of a chat. Then welcome to the Nerds from the Crypt podcast.